Hello, I'm Rosemary Martirana, Director of Intelligence here at the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness, NJOHSP, and you're listening to Intelligence Unclassified. This podcast is exactly what the title states, unclassified information about current trends in homeland security for the state of New Jersey, as well as educational information and resources for your awareness. Although it is produced every month, we aim to stay on top of current events and will often offer additional content. If this is your first time listening, then thanks for coming. Please feel free to add this podcast to your RSS feed or iTunes. You can also follow NJOHSP on Twitter at NJOHSP and Facebook. All links can be found in the show note and on our website, www.njohsp.gov. The events of 2015 highlight that New Jersey and the United States face a terrorist landscape more dangerous than any since the attacks of September 11th in 2001. From the brutal and tragic attacks in San Bernardino and Paris, the year saw a dramatic rise in multi-operative, small-scale attacks on civilian soft targets, all with little to no warning, as well as the decentralization and diffusion of the global terrorism movement. This new dynamic makes it extremely difficult for law enforcement and homeland security professionals at all levels of government to detect and deter attacks like San Bernardino, Paris, Philadelphia, or Boston. Now more than ever, state and local coordination is critical to combating the evolving and diffuse terrorist threat we face. Homeland security has become hometown security, and OHSP is working diligently with our partners to stay abreast of terrorist capabilities. This three-part series was adopted from a webinar our office hosted in January and is intended to expand on some of the themes presented in NJOHSP's 2016 threat assessment, which is available on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Episode 1 discusses the increase in competition between the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, and Al-Qaeda that we expect to see in 2016. Episode 2 takes a hard look at domestic extremism throughout the United States, while the third episode explores the concept of blended extremism, or individuals that draw their inspiration from multiple radical ideologies and tailor these beliefs to ultimately form a unique worldview to advance their violent goals. You may recognize the voices of our Analysis Bureau Chief, Dean Barada, and our Deputy Bureau Chief, Kim Brown, in this podcast, who were featured in our HVE speaker series. But before I turn the mic over to them, thank you for your continued support to the New Jersey Office of Homeland Security and Preparedness.
So the next issue we have is domestic terrorism. And as you may have guessed already, Kim is a big, I don't want to say a fan of domestic terrorism, but let's just say that's where her interests generally lie. So I'll let her take over with this part.
Thank you. So if you have the threat assessment in front of you, or, you know, you can take a look at it later. 2015 was an interesting year for domestic terrorism. We saw an array of plots and attacks from domestic extremists, including white supremacists, black separatists, anti-abortion extremists, sovereign and militia extremists. And the event that stands out for me from 2015 was that of white supremacists. Specifically Dylann Roof. So Dylann Roof, he was a self-radicalized white nationalist. And just a little background on the event. So it was last June where he shot and killed 9 African Americans during a prayer service. And just in reading his manifesto, Roof was drawn to the white supremacist ideology after doing research on the Trayvon Martin shooting, as well as the events in Baltimore regarding Freddie Gray. Now, what kind of struck me with this individual is in his research that he was doing, he was pointed to the conservative citizens, to their website, which they pushed a lot of black on white crime. And so Roof actually states in the manifesto, the first website I came to was the Council of Conservative Citizens. And there were pages upon pages of brutal black-on-white murders. And so just based on the manifesto and his writings, it was clear that he was fixated on highlighting inferiority of other races, discussing IQ and crime. And so it was almost similar to that, what you would find on Stormfront.
So, yeah, you know, and one other really interesting thing that makes domestic terrorism is much harder to track, quantify, understand, report on than international terrorism. And one of the reasons why, Dylann Roof actually pointed out in his manifesto, and he talked about, and I don't remember the exact wording, but it was something like, hey, the KKK isn't doing anything anymore, neo-Nazis aren't doing anything anymore, so it's up to me, I need to do it. And in a very crude way, that really sums up the domestic terrorism experience that we've seen over the past maybe 20 years increasingly happening. the days of the KKK, you know, 50 or 100 guys dressing up in sheets and going to lynch somebody, those are getting increasingly rare. Instead, what we're seeing is sort of individuals deciding that they need to act on their own. And that, for reasons we're going to talk about in a little bit, makes it really tough to try to parse out what is the real motivation of these folks. Are they a terrorist? Are they just psychotically disturbed? Do they have personal grievances? Is this workplace violence? All these questions and swirl around, particularly if the individual is killed, so you can't talk to them, and if they don't leave behind a manifesto, that can make this sort of parsing of who they are and what their motivations are really, really difficult. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because he left the manifesto, it kind of gives you an idea as far as how far along he was in the white supremacist ideology. And I believe the quote that, you know, Dean was talking about, he said, "We have no skinheads, no real KKK, no one doing anything but talking on the internet. Well, someone has to have the bravery to take it to the real world, and I guess that has to be me." So he took it into his own hands. And I think that that's the hard part for law enforcement and as an analyst, kind of finding those lone individuals that, you know, kind of had enough and are going to take things into their own hands. But the bigger thing, well, not bigger thing, but what kind of manifested from this one incident is that we had the removal of the Confederate flag. And I think that also caused kind of an uproar with other white supremacist groups, black separatist groups. So in 2015, July last year, the New Black Panther Party, as well as the KKK, held simultaneous protests regarding the removal of the flag outside the South Carolina State House. There was a lot of inflammatory remarks going back and forth, but law enforcement was able to maintain order. But with this event, there was kind of like a domino effect, which impacted or spurred other groups into being motivated to do something.
So it was interesting too. I was just having a conversation yesterday about domestic terrorist groups, and somebody was arguing, should we even consider them rational or irrational persons? I think they are rational. The caveat to that is, assuming you buy into their assumptions about how the world is. And I think that's one of the things when we're talking about a number of white separatist extremists, particularly like Dylann Roof, or even a lot of anti-government extremists, their reality, their worldview is just significantly different from almost everybody else's. And in both of those cases, they are frequently convinced, for example, that our country is so fragile that it's only going to take one incident, right? Dylann Roof was convinced that his action was going to be the spark that ignited the race war. So his understanding of this country wasn't clear. Likewise, I'll sort of jump ahead a little bit when we talk about the Oregon folks and the standoff there. Deep-seated in that ideology is that this country is sort of one event away from a second American Revolution. And, you know, all that needs to happen is one spark and sort of all Americans will sort of, you know, wake up and sort of see terrible thing that's going on. So it's interesting to sort of just be aware that they may not be irrational. They just have sort of insulated their understanding of the environment, their worldviews, to such a degree that they're only getting information which sort of supports their preconceived notions. And that twists their understanding of reality.
So a good example of that is like when we talk about sovereign citizens and, you know, we kind of laugh about the ideology or some of the things that they do. So for those of you that don't know, sovereign citizens believe that the government is illegitimate and they don't have to abide by certain laws or any laws for that matter. But then when you interact with the sovereign citizen or the terminology that they're using, you know, you think it's kind of funny or it's weird, but they truly and wholeheartedly believe in the ideology. And all it takes is for one to either place a lien or to get out of a ticket. And that kind of lets the others know, hey, this does work, and sends the message, okay, we can all do it.
What somebody told me when I first got into this field a long time ago, you don't need to be a genius to be a criminal. You don't need to be Einstein to be a terrorist. Almost anyone can pull a trigger. Almost anyone can detonate a bomb. So that is important. No matter how strange or weird a particular ideology may seem to us, that does not necessarily mean they are harmless. And that's important to mention. Do we see Dylann Roof attacks sort of like that occurring more? This is one of the real challenges we face. When we're talking about domestic terrorism, there are a number of challenges to finding out about them. A lot of times, domestic terrorist incidents do not get attention beyond a local or maybe regional level. It's just a lot harder to break through into national media attention. Dylann Roof being one notable exception, but had he not killed anyone, had he killed maybe one person or maybe wounded some people, it's not clear to me we would have gotten nearly the same amount of media attention. Whereas international terrorist incidents seem to garner a lot more media attention. And that's just one thing that is tough for us, is sometimes we don't even find out about these incidents until weeks or months later. There can be some confusion between what is a domestic terrorist incident versus what is a hate crime. So that can muddy the waters as well. We would know if there were sort of mass white supremacist shootings going on every day. So I guess there is a lot more domestic terrorist attacks going on than I think most people would be aware of just by sort of consuming daily news.
So the new Black Panther Party ranked low for the threat assessment, but we did keep them because we wanted to point out the new Black Panther Party. They had one plot in 2015, and these two individuals, Olajuwon Ali and Orlando Baldwin, they were targeting the St. Louis Arch, the prosecutors, and I believe a sheriff. So this was the only plot that they had for the year. And the last time we saw the new Black Panther Party as a whole mobilize and actually unify was during the Zimmerman trial. So they rallied together. Everyone went down to Sanford, Florida to kind of be there for the trial, to support the Martin family. And that was where we actually saw them, you know, work as one team. Usually they're very fragmented. You know, they'll call for rallies. No one will show up, but that's where we saw something actually happen. But then when we fast forward to 2015 for this plot, we didn't see a lot of activity from the new Black Panther Party. We didn't see the rallying together that we saw with the Trayvon Martin case. Actually, it kind of fell on dead ears, and I don't know if that was from the Black Lives Matter movement, which kind of maybe took over the momentum or took the momentum from the Black separatist movement.
So yeah, one of the things that we always are thinking about is extremist movements don't operate in a vacuum. And so it may be that sort of legitimate political expression just is right now seen as sort of being able to make progress, or they don't see it as a lost cause. Whereas maybe on the anti-government side, the extremists there sort of are increasingly rejecting the existing political system as being legitimate and being able to address their grievances. So that might push them more to extremism. So not uncommon, probably what we saw in the 60s, very similar, just, you know, if you flip the political spectrum over, where a lot of leftist extremists didn't see the political system as being able to sort of accomplish what they wanted to do, and so they moved more to extremist and violent activity. We may be seeing sort of the opposite of that, or something similar like that going on today.
And, you know, just to throw out one more example, in Baltimore, Black Lives Matter, they had a rally. I believe the new Black Panther Party showed up, and the audience and the organizers, I believe, actually booed them off. So not wanted at the rally and demonstrations. So we're going to move into the Oregon occupation. So just as a little background, early in the new year, militia members occupied or took over a federal building in Oregon in response to the additional or adjusted jail time of the sentencing of Dwight Hammond and his son Stephen. They both were incarcerated for burning federal land. And so Ammon Bundy, he's the son of Cliven Bundy, who had his own run-in with federal authorities over grazing rights. So he actually kind of took this on when he saw that the individuals were going to have a adjusted sentencing. And so what we saw there was kind of a call for individuals to come and support. So I believe, again, in looking back at the Bundy standoff, we had anti-government individuals, white supremacists, as well as militia individuals, and I'm sure sovereign individuals, all coming to this one area to either support or whatever their intent was for this matter, whether it's to support or to cause problems.
And so, you know, one of the questions is, hey, you're in New Jersey. Why do we care what's going on in Oregon? I think there's a couple reasons for that. The first is you're never quite sure with any extremist sort of what is going to be that spark that motivates them. With this particular movement, the militia movement, anti-government extremist movement, for some time they have been looking for that spark that they think is going to ignite the second American Revolution and take back your country, all that sort of stuff. So before this one, there were two other...
Like mini-standoffs.
Mini standoffs that they were hoping to sort of generate nationwide traction to. So this could happen anywhere. The issues that they are particularly attracted to are those of sort of eminent domain, government, what they perceive government overreach, that sort of thing. That can happen in any state whatsoever. And what is particularly interesting is the people who are protesting here, the people who are seizing this government property, are not locals. They are coming from all across the country. And so if this happens in our jurisdiction, your jurisdiction, you could be seeing people come from 2, 3, 4, all the way, you know, states away, all the way across the country. You don't know who they are. You don't know what their criminal pedigree, if any, is. You don't know what their intent is. And certainly that has been an issue in Oregon, is a lot of people, law enforcement, families of law enforcement, the general public, have felt threatened, in some cases, you know, intentionally threatened, but other cases just threatened because there's all these guys walking around with guns who they don't know who it is. So the potential is there for what could be otherwise deemed a minor criminal incident to sort of explode if it gets sort of that viral connectivity.
Right. Yeah. And I think we moved into the standoff Tuesday after the arrest of Ammon Bundy, because the FBI gave those that were left there the opportunity to leave. So as I was kind of watching things unfold and, you know, was online seeing what was going on. So some people were leaving, but just earlier today, there was a call for people to actually come to the federal building and actually support those who are left. I don't know if people are actually going to turn around and come back, but so, you know, kind of to add on to what Dean said is that, you know, you don't know who you have coming there. So it could be people that, you know, actually do support the Hammonds, or it could be people there that are looking to cause trouble.
And so I think this brings up a great point that I think is important to emphasize. And that is, there is a difference that we are very aware of and we take very seriously between legitimate protests and extremism and terrorism. So we are not concerned. If somebody does not think, for example, in this Oregon case or Black Lives Matter or the Occupy movement, we do not care if somebody thinks that a particular judicial ruling is unconstitutional or incorrect, or that the financial system is corrupt. None of that is of any concern to us. The distinction is when somebody says that I am so outraged by this that I am willing to conduct criminal activity and violent activity in support of changing that system. When I am willing to intimidate, coerce a government or some segment of the population in furtherance of that social, political, ideological, religious motivation, that's when it crosses over into extremist terrorist activity. So we spend a lot of time talking about these cases, and when there are sort of standoffs like this, making sure that we are not really concerned with the protest part of it, but we're looking for the fringe elements that often attract to the edges of those protest movements.
Yes.
That are usually trying to incite or conduct violent criminal activity on their own.
So I have Dean Barada here with me now, and I wanted to follow up with a few other questions. So, Dean, we talked a little bit about in the threat assessment the threat posed by domestic terrorist groups such as militia extremists, sovereign citizens. Can we go into a little more detail on that? What have we seen as it relates to the militia movement in the last year or so?
So after 1995 and the Oklahoma City bombing, you saw the militia movement sort of contract and go into decline for quite a while, probably 10 or 15 years. And then starting in the mid to late 2000s, what happened was you saw a resurgence. And it's been interesting to see how the movement has sort of morphed and fractured since then. So sovereign citizens became, let's say, a splinter off of that anti-government movement. You saw the militia movement generally move away and separate from white supremacy. There's still some connections there, but you've seen those become more distinct as well. But throughout all of those, you've seen sort of a resurgence in anti-government sentiment. And the important thing to remember here when we're talking about these groups, we're not just looking at individuals who express anti-government sentiment. It is that sentiment coupled with that commitment to violence in order to effect change or intimidate the government or population within the U.S. Those two boxes have to be checked to sort of fall into this group that we're talking about now.
So if those two boxes need to be checked, looking at what we saw in Oregon earlier this year, how would we classify that type of movement? Obviously, there were several militia members there, but no violence really occurred in any way. How can we caveat that? What do we want to say about that?
So the FBI's definition of terrorism is violence or the threat of violence. And I think, well, there was violence. During the arrests, one of the members of that standoff did reach for a gun, by all accounts, and was killed as a result of that. So that's violence, but I don't think that's even the main point. If you look at the rhetoric throughout that six-week standoff, there was repeated and widespread calls for violence against federal officials. According to local law enforcement on the scene, they and their families were subject to intimidation by these folks. So for me, by any sort of reading of that event, there was absolutely the threat of violence there, and that fits right in with the FBI's definition of terrorism. And they were explicitly clear about wanting to coerce the government for social, political, or religious reasons, in this case political, so they checked the box, really.
So do you think we're going to see more movements like this in the next year or so? Was this a win for them, a success?
This is going to be interesting to see. So clearly after the Bundy Ranch standoff in 2014, that ended and the movement clearly saw that as a victory. This one, I think we're still going to wait to see how this shakes out for a couple reasons. One is it ended in the arrest of many of the perpetrators, including Cliven Bundy, who was involved in the Bundy Ranch standoff because of events, it looks like, in 2014. So it's a lot less clear that somebody's won. Within the movement itself, there was a lot of criticism that despite calls for solidarity, despite calls for support, the folks at the refuge did not get the huge outpouring of support of people actually showing up with guns that they apparently expected. And so it's not clear to me if that's going to cause some rethinking about just how popular this ideology is. I think a lot of people were under the misperception that there was sort of widespread support for their activity. And then thirdly, though, is just like we saw with Dylann Roof, and I think we mentioned this in the podcast, the concern is not necessarily where sort of organized groups are going to be. They've got some soul searching to do, but it's going to be people who are disenchanted that the movement wasn't able to sort of pull it together and who decide that they need to take individual action. And so the first thing that comes to my mind there is, again, Dylann Roof's manifesto, which really is sort of a call to individual leaderless resistance. And that's a danger that's going to be really hard to quantify.
And that's a good way into kind of discussing sovereign citizens as well. A movement, if you want to call it that, that's much more decentralized. In your opinion, have we seen the sovereign citizen extremist movement expand in the last several years? Or is it simply just more people are aware of it, so we're seeing more people discuss it and report that information?
So sovereigns are really interesting for a couple reasons. The first is the vast majority of sovereign citizens are not extremists and are not a threat. And that needs to really be emphasized. The second part of that is sovereign citizen extremists have really sort of come to attention because of a few high profile, very deadly events. And so I think in some cases, some folks are still trying to get their head around how to sort of distinguish those two. But again, the important thing to remember is the ideology is kind of secondary to the violence and the threat of violence. And when you have that and it's ideologically driven, that's where we're really concerned. In terms of the spread of sovereign citizen ideology, it's hard to say. I think a lot more individuals, a lot more agencies are sort of attuned to it. And so when they see that more, they want to report it. I still think we have some work to do in sort of distinguishing the threat of violence with the ideology so that we're not just looking at folks who are expressing their political ideology. But anecdotally, it does seem like there's been more activity over the past couple years. Where it gets increasingly difficult is where you're seeing sort of this blending of ideologies. So you're seeing, Oregon is sort of a good recent example, where you're seeing traditional militia folks taking some sovereign citizen ideology or vice versa and sort of combining that and seeing these ideologies evolve. So we're seeing them sort of combine together, split apart, that sort of thing. The third thing that I find interesting and not often talked about sovereigns is sometimes they're victims. Some sovereign citizens purport to advertise ways to get out of paying your taxes, ways to get out of paying your mortgage, that sort of thing. And they're selling, in some cases, ways to do that. And they're actually preying on people who don't know that this stuff is fraudulent and a scam and is not going to work for them. And so in some cases, you have people driven out of desperation to try anything. And so they see somebody saying, I'll get you out of your mortgage for $2,000. And these people pay up thinking that it's going to work. And then they not only are out their home or whatever, but they're also at this extra money they've paid. So sometimes we talk about sovereign citizen extremists, but sometimes sovereign citizens are victims, and it's important to keep that in mind and as we're sort of engaging with our communities.
Great. Well, thanks for sitting down today, Dean. And if you're looking for more information on the domestic terrorism threat specific to New Jersey, please visit our website at www.njohsp.gov. And remember, stay safe and Jersey strong.
Again, all links can be found in the show notes and on our website at www.njohsp.gov. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to subscribe to Intelligence Unclassified.